Today we have a very interesting session. This is the last concurrent session of the day, so be really excited. The session today is on actuarial offshoring, and we have some amazing presenters here today with us. So we have Ruth, who is a fellow of the Actuarial Institute. She started off as a life and a superannuation actuary, something I share with her, and she has moved into the general insurance industry, and she's currently working at Suncorp. Followed by her, we have Stephanie, who would be presenting to us as well, and she's also from Suncorp, and she has extensive experience within the personal lines home insurance and motor insurance, and has experience around the risk and demand modeling, optimization, profitability projections, building platforms, and delivering pricing advice. So a very interesting fact, she also does the reviews for University Part 1 accreditation, so now when my students ask me, I'm going to send them your way. And finally, who we have Case presenting, who's from Deloitte, and all I could gather from his CV was he's very talented. So he has experience in reserving, pricing, capital modeling, M&As, basically anything that comes to your mind which is remotely actuarial, Case probably knows about it. And he's also an appointed actuary for a number of clients and also presents regularly on topical subjects such as telematics, logic, GI pricing, insurance cycle management, and a lot more stuff that I'm not going to go into the details of. So without much further ado, let's get started.
Okay. Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming this afternoon to listen to our presentation on actuarial offshoring. Will you be here in 10 years' time? Yesterday, when we were listening to the climate change speech, I thought of this question and thought, well, will anyone be here in 10 years' time? However, for the next 40 minutes at least, I think we're safe, and we'll just stick to the actuarial offshoring. So this is a big question, and we did a lot of research around the topic, and the paper which supports the presentation is essentially a research paper, and the research that's available is enormous. There's an absolute plethora of information available that we went through, dating back quite a few years, but what was interesting is that there wasn't too much mention of actuarial profession in the topic of offshoring. Until recently-ish, there's been a couple of mentions, hence the interest in the topic. And I know for some people here in the room, it's already real for you. But the purpose of our paper was to provide some background history, identify some of the challenges and opportunities, and have an opinion on what it might mean for the actuarial profession. So that's going to be the basis of our discussion today. I'll do the history part and take you up to the current day. Steph will take you through the challenges and opportunities, and Case will finish with a conclusion and hopefully answer the big question, will you be here in 10 years' time? So, it's nothing new. The history of offshoring, of course, started with outsourcing. And everyone outsources, right? From a business point of view, I mean, the Romans outsourced the collection of taxes many years ago. So it's very historical. Businesses at the moment outsource printing, mail house services, IT, claims triage, customer relationships, and even at a personal level, everyone outsources something. If you think about it, it's just embedded so much in your life that you probably take it for granted. But think about tax returns, personal shoppers, hairdressers, cleaning, cooking, childcare. It's all outsourcing. And basically, where there is a comparative advantage in a third party doing a process, then that's when outsourcing is considered. Then we look at offshoring, and early offshoring, of course, was limited by the ability to travel and communicate. But as we step through history, we've got the telegraph, railroad, air travel, computers, internet, social media, iPhone, and the list goes on and on and on. But it made companies move from thinking nationally to thinking internationally as the barriers were lifted. And there's lots of ways to look at offshoring. And throughout the papers, various authors use different terminology. This group of three topics was put together by Dr. Grant, who did a paper for the government in 2005. And he looked at offshoring in terms of political production and services. Political was where countries were the offshorers rather than corporations, and it was associated with the European colonisation. Then as barriers to trade reduced and capital could be freed up, between countries, production offshoring happened in the 1970s. Moving through to the 1990s, of course, the white-collar jobs started to move offshore with the rapid advancement in communications and IT. Now, if we just look at the services part, this can be broken down into information, business processes, and the thinking part. The common terminology that you'll see when you're looking at any sort of offshoring is the ITO, the BPO, and the KPO. So the IT is IT, outsourcing. BP is the business processes. And then the KP is the knowledge processing outsourcing. And it's these three latter types that we'll be considering mostly in our paper and in our discussions this afternoon. And, of course, it's the KPO, which is really where the actuarial services might lie. So I'm just going to briefly show you the growth over the last 10 years or so in business process services. This particular paper looked at a segment in the business services area which was primarily finance, HR and IT, and this cohort related to companies that were headquartered in North America and Europe. So the total number of jobs that were in this sector around 2002 was around 8 million. So there's a couple of good observations about this. It's firstly, the green section represents the number of jobs that have been offshored, and the author of the paper also did a small projection into 15, 16 and 17. It's about 2.5 million jobs. Now, that's a fair chunk out of the initial labour force of 8 million. The other interesting observation is the grey middle part. So that's the diminishing number of offshoreable jobs. And this particular author suggested that they will run out because there is a certain number of jobs which are simply not offshoreable. And I'll come back to that because that's quite an important point, and it leads us through into the KPO, really. So, with the growth of the offshoring industry, I mean, there's enablers which have sort of encouraged the growth, made it easier, and there were disruptors. So for the enablers, the three major ones have been economic reforms, really hugely started in the 1970s, technological advancements, and we don't need to talk about those, they're obvious, and the availability of skilled resources. So just on that latter point, we found some statistics that UNESCO put out which have the education ratios, simply the proportion of children who attend school across many different countries. And they also had ratios on tertiary education, so university levels. And what was clear was that although the developed nations had much higher ratios, the developing nations' ratios have actually doubled in the last 10 years. So there is a ready, able and willing workforce out there from which to which the jobs can go. On the disruptor side for the industry, these are mainly really big things such as terrorism and war, natural disasters and economic downturns. So when I was reading on the history of offshoring, these disruptors really served to change the focus towards compliance. So there was disaster recovery, business continuity that did make some of the costs of offshoring increase. Okay, now, here we talk a little bit more detail about the BPO and the KPO. First of all, I have to thank our friends at KPMG for this graph. It was in a paper that they put together in 2008. It's not our work, this one. But it enables us to break down the business services, and this is relating to the finance sector in particular. And it's a really excellent graph because it breaks down work into the depth of the work, which is across the x-axis. So on the left-hand side, you'll see the tasks or the processes are rule-based. So they are processes, they are formulaic, they can even follow a script. And as you move across to the right, there's more judgment that's included in the ability to do the roles. And this is the key difference between the BPO and the KPO, and you'll see actuarial services up there in the top right-hand corner as having a high business value with lots of judgment that's required. This was one of actually the first papers that I actually saw actuarial services mentioned in an offshoring nature. And I might say that the concept of jobs not being offshoreable is really challenged by this, because this is saying that when you put together jobs in this sort of view, why can't knowledge services be offshored? And the guys will talk further about this later. So just to support further the development of the offshoring industry. So ITO is just well and truly developed. This is a Deloitte survey result where the respondents were asked what sort of services they currently outsource. And for the IT industry, I guess it's no big surprise that almost more than 50% are already being outsourced. And that's, you know, acceptable to everyone in the room. It's well and truly embedded. And you can see the finance functions are about almost a quarter are being outsourced. And Steph has got a slide that follows this one, which has what the respondents then plan to do in addition, and you'll see growth in these areas as well. Now, to put some of this into perspective for the Australian market, one of the observations made in one of the research papers was that it changes, the amount of offshoring changes the profile of the existing labour force. So in the Australian labour force, over the last 5 years or so, the real growth in jobs has been in what is known as interaction jobs. So these are ones that require reasoning and judgment. They're not the rule-based ones. So the jobs that are left onshore have this sort of profile, and the number of outsourcing process-type jobs is decreasing. So that, of course, changes the profile of the type of employee as well, and the guys will talk about that later. So just before I hand over to Steph, destinations for outsourcing, again from the Deloitte survey. I guess it's no big surprise that India is up there at the top. This was a question about outsourcing, so that's why the US is there. But you can see all of the other countries are up there as well. The developed here, by the way, means how developed they are in terms of offshoring, not in terms of their economy. Okay, so I'll hand over to Steph. Thank you.
Thanks, Ruth. So given the current state of offshoring, let's now have a look at the benefits that companies around the world are deriving as a result of offshoring, as well as the challenges that they're facing. So the point is not to argue either for or against it, but just to highlight some of the practical considerations that need to be thought through. So cost saving is the most obvious benefit, with the wage differential between the onshore and the offshore countries being the biggest driver of this. But what we also need to consider is wage inflation. So in countries like China and India, wages are rising at rates of, say, 8 to 11% per year, and it ranges up to 30% for the jobs that are really in demand. So what this means is at some point in time in the future, there's going to come a time when the wage gap closes and that labour arbitrage opportunity disappears. So what will happen at that point in time? One possibility is that previously offshore work will move back onshore. But what we think is more likely to happen is that the offshoring destination will just move from whatever country it currently is at to another country that has lower wages. So Ruth's graph earlier showed that countries like South Africa and Israel and Ecuador, they're not currently the most popular choices for offshoring, but they are being considered by businesses as future opportunities. And South Africa is of particular interest to us because there's already a lot of actuaries working in South Africa, and they're really driving growth in that high value adding KPO space. So it's possible that we might expect more actuarial work to get offshored to South Africa in future. What this means for businesses is they need a long-term strategy that anticipates the need to move from one location to another. So whether they want to do this by partnering with a number of offshore vendors in different countries and diversifying across vendors, or whether they want to partner with one global vendor that has offices in a number of countries, that's up to the business to decide, but it is something that needs to be considered. And apart from cost saving, the other major benefit of offshoring is the ability to access extra capacity. So that frees up onshore resources to do work that can add more value to the business or to spend more time communicating insights to the business. And not only can you do more of the same types of work, but you can also leverage off the knowledge of the offshore vendors to do types of work that you may not have the in-house knowledge to do. So if there's a new product, you don't know how to price, or a new model that your team has never built before, that's when the knowledge and the experience of the offshore vendor might come in handy. Now, the downside to this is the loss of intellectual property and intellectual capital. So I refer to intellectual property as things like SAS processes and spreadsheets and pricing algorithms that you will need to give the vendor access to so they can fulfill their side of the contract. But somewhere in your agreement, you'll have to specify how you're going to protect this intellectual property. And this includes not just what existed before the agreement began, but also what gets created during the term of the offshoring agreement. Intellectual capital is a bit less tangible. So that refers to the skills that your team develops as a result of doing their day-to-day jobs and the technical expertise. Of course, if it's being done offshore, then it's the offshore team that's developing their intellectual capital instead of your onshore team. So there's nothing really stopping the offshore team from using the skills that they've learnt on other projects for other clients. And in the future, those clients may happen to be your competitors. So that's something that needs to be considered. The other thing I want to talk about is culture. So culture refers to both corporate culture and national culture. So on one hand, people who come from a different background can bring different ways of thinking and different ways of doing things, which can enrich your team dynamic. But on the other hand, the cultural differences can cause misunderstandings to happen. And I'll illustrate this with an example. So a manager asks an onshore analyst, "Is your report going to be ready by the Friday deadline?" And the analyst replies, "No, because the SAS server was down, I couldn't extract my data, it's not going to be ready until the Tuesday after." It's a straight answer to a straight question, and it's the kind of thing that you and I probably find pretty normal. Now, this manager asks the same question of an offshore analyst. We'll say they're in India for the purpose of this example. He asks them, "Is the report going to be ready by the Friday deadline?" And this Indian analyst replies, "It might be ready. We're working on it." Now, this analyst is not deliberately trying to be dishonest. It's just that for him culturally, it's considered to be really rude to dispute your boss. So what he's expecting is for the manager to pick up on the might be ready and question him further so he has a chance to explain his problems. But if the manager just doesn't understand this, then he's going to assume that everything is okay. And when it comes to Friday, he'll get a nasty surprise. So these kinds of communication differences can be a cause of frustration for onshore people working with offshore people. And it does take time and effort to learn how to communicate across cultures. And it's made especially difficult by the fact that most of the time you're probably only communicating by email because of the time zone difference. But it is one of the challenges that needs to be worked through. So we've talked about the current state of things. Let's now explore what we expect to happen in the offshoring space in the future. And we saw this blue chart earlier when Ruth was talking about what companies are currently offshoring and how we saw how IT was by far the most commonly outsourced business function. Now, this green graph shows the survey responses of the same companies to what their future plans are for outsourcing. And I'm not going to go into the details about each individual business function, but what's immediately evident is that there is no longer one dominant business function that people are looking to offshore anymore. So this illustrates the point that Ruth was making earlier, that what was once considered non-offshoreable is now offshoreable, and offshoring is moving up the value chain out of ITO into BPO and KPO. And now I'll talk about what kinds of factors are influencing these trends in the offshoring market. Firstly, cloud computing. So independent of their offshoring strategy, businesses are looking at cloud computing for reasons like making their data easier to access and being able to scale up and down as needed. But cloud technology also happens to be an enabler of cloud-based offshoring. So we envisage in the future that companies will be able to hire talent and form virtual teams of experts to work on projects, and it doesn't matter anymore where people are located geographically. And also being able to move data quickly from one country to another makes it easy not just to move data from your onshore data center to an offshore provider, but also to shift providers. So has the wage gap closed? Has wage inflation caught up in India? No problem, just click a button and shift it all to China or South Africa or wherever it is that you want. The other trend that we're seeing is that relationships with offshore vendors are moving beyond the traditional transaction-based model towards managed service models. So what this means is that instead of just paying for an offshore provider to give us 10 call centre staff to be at work 8 hours a day, it's the whole end-to-end management of the whole business function that's being offshored. So that leaves it up to the vendor to find process improvement possibilities to improve their efficiency and to improve their own bottom lines. This helps align the interests of the client and the vendor, and it makes more sense in the context of KPO, where the type of work being outsourced is more complex. And lastly, analytics. So analytics has been mentioned a lot today. There are plenty of companies that can see the potential of social media data and mobile data, but they might not have the internal expertise in analytics to make the most of it. And in addition, the local supply of analytics professionals isn't going to keep up with the projected demand over the next few years. So the talent shortage combined with the labour cost arbitrage opportunity is going to drive analytics outsourcing in the future. So now I'll pass over to Case to tell us what this means for us as actuaries.
Thanks, Steph. So we saw from Ruth's diagram earlier, actuarial services were actually in the top right-hand part of the sort of complex judgment high value. So we as actuaries took that and expanded it a bit more. So we know that not everything we do is complex judgment. And so we created what you see on the left-hand side, things that are more rules-based, you know, data extraction, production, reconciliations, those kinds of things. And then all the way to what we call basic modeling and basic monitoring versus advanced monitoring, advanced monitoring and modeling. By advanced, we actually don't mean necessarily technical ability or technically advanced, or it's more about judgment. How much judgment is there in building a model? So, you can see this graph. Now, this is our actuarial work. Of course, we came up with this. There are many ways to slice the pie, but at least that's our take of it. If we take an example of a reserving exercise, well, you've got data preparation, experience monitoring, all of that is data driven. These are the offshored elements, by the way, I'm going through. Model preparation, put the parameters from last year, all of that doesn't really need much judgment. Model validation in terms of technical reviews and so on, even impact assessment. Why did the results move from last year to this year? A quick reconciliation exercise. It can even go towards report templates. Fulfilling them. So we see those kinds of things. Just if we take the reserving exercise, those types of tasks are potentially offshoreable. The onshore team may then retain sort of oversight on, the depth of knowledge they have of the local market, the APRA requirements or ASIC or other regulatory requirements, retaining the responsibility for selecting the final parameters, communication to management, post-balance sheet adjustments, those kinds of things. And we may think, well, there's more offshore than onshore, but maybe that's not something to worry about. We'll find out soon. But there are three key messages emerging from this graph when we blew up all of our tasks. Firstly, rules-based tasks. These are process-oriented. They don't need the business knowledge. So, yes, there's very much, and already a number of companies are doing this, very much a chance of offshoring this. The ones that require more judgment, such as, analysis, building the model from scratch, manipulating the data, monitoring, getting some messages. You can say, well, that's an element of judgment. That's KPO, knowledge process offshoring. It can be done, but I think it's really up to the company and its risk appetite. How willing is the company to deal with the challenges of offshoring? How willing are they to teach the vendor that will offshore to? So I think that's a decision to be made by the company. Now, the last one, complex judgment, and that's really about when there's not much data or we have to build a model from scratch or come up with a concept from scratch. You can say that that's something that will stay. Senior management does not want to offshore this kind of thing. But even then, if senior management is comfortable, can we think of an offshored appointed actuary? If they have 5 years post-qualification experience, equivalent to something that we have in Australia, can the appointed actuary be in an offshored location? Don't know. I suppose we've got to look at the APRA requirements for Australian residency. So with this trend in mind, the environment which actuaries operate in will change over time. Offshoring, I think, will be one of the key drivers of what we will do in the future. Even if we, over the last few days, we heard about the Australia-China Fair Trade Agreement. A large part of this is not manufacturing and resources, it's about services. A large part of that will be financial services and insurance services. So this is all pointing towards that trend, towards things moving to this offshore. There was even, with Modi, President, Prime Minister Modi being here, talks about Australia-India Fair Trade Agreements. So the sort of things that actuaries in the future will develop, there'll be certain skills. We talked about insight and communication already, but an interesting one is managing offshore relationships. In this instance, the relationship management, project management skills, they'll become increasingly important for the onshore actuaries. Working with offshore partners, communicating remotely, working around time zones, it's all these kinds of skills, collaborating with different cultures. These are the kind of skills that are needed for managing these offshore relationships. Understanding strategy and local concept and local context, actuaries, of course, need to have a good understanding of the business goals and the dynamics of the local market. That is what adds value to the onshore actuary. Innovation is an interesting one because I think a successful actuary will be one that thinks outside the box and you're asking creative questions. These ideas can be developed from ground up, from scratch, by the onshore actuary, passed offshore for them to develop that idea and then send it back. So that's a concept that can happen. Technically, I think as organizations increase their offshore support functions, this will have implications, we feel, on the junior actuaries entering the profession. If we consider a simple example of the outstanding claims, the elements of the value chain that are offshoreable are likely to be the ones that are the junior actuaries are currently fulfilling. So this raises the question about learning and development for the junior actuaries, and where the basics have been offshored, how will we teach the junior actuaries to have the right skills and to grow into the senior actuaries? So now to the question, will you be here in 10 years' time? I mean, it's clear offshoring as a business strategy has been around for a long time. Recently, it has begun to extend into into the domain of the actuarial profession. So, and this has been driven by the various combinations that Ruth and Steph mentioned. There is evidence to suggest, and we see that increasingly, that this trend will continue. It is here to stay, that's for sure. And there are certainly elements of work that we as onshore actuaries are performing, which can be relatively easily offshored. So, before we answer the question, I suppose if I was to ask you that question, do you think you'll be here in 10 years' time? Who says they'll be here in 10 years' time? Okay, and who says they won't be here in 10 years' time? Okay, I'm thinking the ones that didn't lift their hand as yes, they'll be here, they're the senior ones. No, just joking. So look, I mean, it looks like most of you think you will be here in 10 years' time. The answer, I mean, there's no right answer, but the answer is yes, but perhaps with a new look. Because the onshore actuary will need to be more strategic, more dynamic, more creative, business-driven, all these kinds of things, good communicator. We have to somehow learn to relinquish our data responsibility, our custodianship of the data, give that to somebody else. But without giving up the knowledge. So we want to work with the data insights, but not work on the data. There'll be more front office work for us as onshore actuaries and also us being as relationship managers all the way from junior levels to the senior levels. And that's it. The next slide is an extra one in case you ask a good question.
Thanks, everyone. That was very interesting. Before I forget, don't forget about the feedback on GIS Connect. And now it's question time. So does anyone have any questions, or should I start with a difficult one? It's an easy one. So recently in the UK, there has been a trend around not offshoring per se, but rather developing regional offices. So PwC and Towers Watson, they have got regional offices in India to actually help with the actuarial services. So how they work is people from the UK office would actually second for 2 years, train up the staff there, and essentially work with them on a day-to-day basis. Do you think that's possibly a business model going forward? Because that'll take care of the IP issues and essentially the cultural differences because you have someone onshore there.
Yeah, thanks. Can you hear me at the back? That's a good question. And in fact, that is already happening in many companies. So we know, and it's publicized. I mean, QBE has a Manila office, for example. Suncorp, for example. Deloitte has an offshore office in India as well. And it's across various skill sets, including actuarial. So I think that's already happening. Mm-hmm. There are various business models for offshoring. So we talked about one concept, but at the back of our paper, we have put a glossary of various models, business models. One of them is called nearshoring. So, you know, if you think about from here to India, there's a time difference. So, you know, that may impinge on how well connected the onshore and offshore entities are. Nearshoring is like somebody in the UK going to Belgium or Poland. And still, it's an offshore concept, but it's much closer.
So there are various business models, and you can read the glossary at the back of the paper if you want more.
So any other questions?
Bill Constantinides, Suncorp. One thing when we do offshoring, I suppose, is our expectation that the offshorer should learn English or should speak English. I don't know whether in your research did you find anything about companies trying to, you know, teach their staff Hindi or you know, other languages to help that cultural element.
I guess we didn't come across that directly, Bill. Do you guys recall seeing anything in the literature about that? No, but the cultural differences were recognised as being one of the challenges, as Steph pointed out. But in terms of that, no, sorry, didn't come across that. But we are aware that companies who do offshore have cultural training available to their internal staff to assist with the process.
You had a question? Do you want me to bring the mic?
One of the things which I've come across on more than one occasion when working with offshoring situations is that particularly with India, which is the main context in which I've worked, they had what appears an unusual practice of thinking it's a good thing to change jobs about every 6 months. So if you look at their CVs, if you saw the same CV in other contexts, you'd think, what's going on here? Are they not committed? Can they not make up their mind? And it did, over there, it was actually normal and showed that you were going places and something was wrong if you weren't changing jobs every 6 months. Does that create issues in terms of the continuity of the knowledge and dealing with a high turnover if you're at the other end and constantly having to develop a new relationship?
Yes, that high turnover is something that's discussed a lot in the literature. So I think I've seen somewhere that it's like 25-35% of staff move jobs every year. And part of the reason for that is, especially in BPO, the people who are doing the work are really highly educated, but they're doing work that's very repetitive and process-driven. So, of course, they want to move, find a change, do more interesting work. The other reason is, anecdotally, I've heard within actuarial work in India, it's possible to double your salary just by moving from one offshore provider to another one. So that's another driver of the high turnover rates. That is a problem in that the intellectual capital that you've built up over that time gets lost, and you have to waste time training up a new person to fill that role. So I guess what that means for businesses is that when they choose an offshore provider, one of the things that they need to think about is the hiring strategy and how they treat their staff, the environment that they provide, as well as the career progression for the staff. And that's one of the things that also needs to be considered.
Can I just add something to
that? Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, just to expand on that, the paper has, from the Deloitte survey again, got a hindsight view of outsourcing. And this was, is that 67?
Yeah.
Build a more robust vendor management capability was 67% of the respondents said that they wish they had done that. And I think, as I recall, there was almost 50% of people said that companies would do it differently if they had the chance to start again. There's a great long list of all of the hindsight view issues in here. So, yeah, have a read of the paper.
We are kind of running short of time, so maybe one last question.
Sorry.
Hi, John Howard here from Suncorp. So just following on from the, I think, the UK experience. So One of my concerns about the whole offshoring thing is that a lot of the actuarial stuff that will get outsourced will be the more junior work, and you know, all of us in the room have learnt our craft through doing all the data manipulation, data cleansing, that sort of thing. What are your guys' views around what will happen where you sort of you outsource all that stuff, and all the senior people then move on? Does that mean that our senior people of the future are going to come from our offshore partners, or how do you see that playing out?
That's actually a good question. One of the things, I mean, I forgot who mentioned that, but the fact that you can second somebody over to so there's a bit of learning from the onshore entity to the offshore provider first up. Once that happens, I mean, there's potential for secondments for the junior guys to go over there and learn the craft so they can come back and manage the work. But it's a new way of working for people entering into our profession. So they have to accelerate quicker through that technical bit and get into the management of the relationship.
Yeah, I guess
you also have to ask whether the education process offered by the Institute needs to change and adapt to take this into account. And I would say that's a yes to that question.
Would you guys all join me in thanking the three of them? And I will hand you your gift shortly.